Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're fresh from the World's 50 Best Restaurant event in New York City. It was the first time that the event has been outside of London. So it was in New York City. And it was a bit chaotic since it was the first time. And then they're going to move it again. Next year it's going to be in Melbourne, Australia.
I think, by the way, I think it was even busier than it's been in London, and it sure was pretty busy in London.
Yeah.
So we captured some interviews for you with some of the celebrity chefs who were there, and bear in mind, if you would, that you might need to turn your volume down because there's a fair amount of background noise, and it's a little bit difficult to hear, but these are some pretty important, pretty interesting kinds of people. And starting off today's program, happiness. I've never seen so much happiness for an award at any of these awards as for Massimo Bottura, who finally made it
to number one
for his restaurant.
He's been kind of sitting at number three for a while now, and last year he was number two, but this year was his year, and boy was he happy, and so was everybody else that he got it. He works very hard. His restaurant is in Modena, and it's called Osteria Francescana, and it's an incredible dining experience. We've been there several times. Anyhow, let's listen to Massimo.
He was just a little bit excited.
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes, fast.
I'm ready.
The reaction. What?
You're number one now. You've always been number one for us, anyhow.
Yeah, I know.
I know. And what next?
Next, I don't know. In my future, there's gonna be always future, and I don't know what it's gonna be. Maybe university. Maybe 100 soup kitchen all over the world, full of art, of culture, to rebuild dignity of the people. And what I have to say, you know, it feels so, my heart is exploding. It's full of everything in 360 degrees meaning, you know, full of pride, of joy, of everything, you know.
I didn't think you'd be tongue-tied. I'm going to ask Laura. Laura, don't go away.
Oh, hold on a second.
I want to ask, because we've had our fingers crossed for 3 years now.
It's
Massimo's turn.
But it's better. Number one.
You didn't need a turn.
I know.
You just had to make it.
I know. But it was like that. You know, we were.
You think it was?
So happy. We were so happy to just arrive here very slowly. Like we built a restaurant, we built it, and we grow very slowly. We achieve every single prize very slowly, because you know you need to do that. You need to have that.
Is the one thing that you can put your finger on that says this is why I'm so proud?
No, I'm proud of my team. You know, I'm proud of my family. You know, they are with me all the time, and you know, they support me like never. We built a family as a team, and so Charlie, Alexa, David and Taka, Beppe and Andrea, you know, we are all a great team and a great family.
Now let's talk to Laura about this. Your later.
Laura, she's partying.
Good
night, everyone. We're going to party.
Are you going to talk about food?
I love you, Bella.
Ciao. Ciao.
Did you hear
this again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah. Over there. I guess
I don't need to. I think that's all we're going to get, huh?
Yeah.
Our next guest, Virgilio Martinez from Central in Lima, Peru, listing fourth in the top 100, top 50 restaurants. He was more excited that he and his wife had succeeded in creating something other than a restaurant. Because they have a six-month-old baby. So when Anne asked, when Anne asked him had he created a new restaurant recently, he said he had, but it was his son who was not there at the event. But Virgilio was there, and a happy camper, and continuing to climb. And who knows where he might climb next.
Virgilio Martinez, you have new restaurants. Would you tell us what they are?
Well, I have an amazing restaurant called Cristobal, which is my son.
And that was when I really started out asking you about your wife, because I heard she was pregnant, but you told me she already has a baby.
Yeah. I mean, like, we had Cristobal, he's 6 months old. Unfortunately, he's not with us. But, you know, he's in Lima with with the nona.
Do you think that there was this wild rise in Peruvian food, a rage over Peruvian food? It seems to have died down. Do you think that it's still coming back?
I think, you know, it's all about trends and fashion, and I don't believe on that. I mean, like, yeah, of course, that's important. Trends, they sometimes they go and then they go away. But I think Peru still. I mean, Peru, we are a very strong country in terms of culture and tradition. So I think in terms of biodiversity. So I think there is a lot of Peru to offer to the world. Yeah.
Aren't you having some difficult political times?
No, I think no. I mean, we just had elections and it turned out to be good, so we're quite happy. We're living good times.
Do you think the Olympics will spill over to other South American countries?
Yeah, maybe quite a bit. Yeah, of course.
All right, you dear, you've got to go. Goodbye.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we're going to Dubai, and we're just in the process of signing that, and yeah, it's going to be, if we do it soon, it's going to be great, and it's going to be, I think, huge, as many things that happen in Dubai.
And number six on the list was Mauro Colagreco, a renowned chef with a restaurant in the south of France called Mirazur. He's celebrating his 10th anniversary with a dinner series of different chefs, top chefs from around the world. He's done two already and has eight to go, and boy, wouldn't they be swell. Anyhow, listen to our interview with Mauro.
Interestingly about Mauro, he's originally from Argentina, but his restaurant, number six, is the top finisher for all the restaurants in France.
I have lived the ups and downs of the pleasures of this chef through all my friends, and I have never, ever eaten his food. But he just invited me to come to the south of France to do that. And we're talking to Mauro Colagreco, who just celebrated his 10th anniversary.
Yes, we opened 10 years ago in Mirazur, in Côte d'Azur.
And, which is near Nice.
Which is?
Near Nice?
It's near Nice. It's near Monte Carlo. It's just 15 kilometers from Monte Carlo. In an amazing place on the view with the Mediterranean Sea. And that's tonight a very nice present for us for 10 years. Yeah.
Your number?
We are number six. So we...
Well, last year, what were you?
11. 2 years in the 11th position, waiting for coming into the 10 best restaurant in the world. And this year is on number six, so it's really amazing.
Mauro, that cannot be bad. That's really a great idea and a story.
Yes, it's a nice story because I'm from Argentina. I'm arrived in France 16 years ago, and I opened my restaurant 10 years ago, and now it's the best restaurant in France. So it's really amazing.
We really would like to sample. You just had the best series. What were the 10 chefs you had cooking 10 different dinners for your 10th anniversary?
Yes, so we doing two dinners already. The first one was my best friend, David Kinch.
I love David Kinch.
Yes, he's a great chef and great friend. He did a fantastic dinner.
The second one was René from Noma. The first one will be Alex Atala from São Paulo, Restaurant Dom. The fourth one is Narizawa from Japan.
We just ate at Narizawa in New York.
Narizawa?
No. Wrong restaurant.
Yes. Yes. So Narizawa from Tokyo. Andoni from Mugaritz from Spain. Virgilio Martinez from Peru. Emmanuel Renault from France. Sebastian Brass from France. Jorge Vallejos from Mexico. And the last one, and the number one, Massimo Bottura.
Massimo is one of our best friends. I adore him. This is at the event where Massimo took over, his Osteria Francescana took over, best restaurant in the world. And I am so happy, I can't even
say it. He's a great, great friend. I'm very, very happy for him, and I'm very happy with his present, because he say always yes when I ask for him to come to cook with me for the 10 years.
Now, are there still available tickets to these dinners? I mean, are they sold out?
It's practically all sold out. We have some places for some dinners, so I invite you to do that by mail to reservation@mirazur.com/fr, France.
Now, I mean, you're South American and you're French. I mean, is your food more French, more modernist, more South American? What?
I trained in France with a great chef. Alain Passard tonight, it was my big master. So, it's a French cuisine, a Mediterranean French cuisine.
Well, I congratulate you on your steady progress. Your 10 years, which in restaurant life is a long time, at the top of your mark here, and I think that's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you.
You are my mail. If you are in Europe, you need to come to visit us. Huh? That I say hello.
Stop there, man.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we were so thrilled to see our dear friend Elena Arzak. And they were number 21 on the list. Was it last year? No, 2 years. When was she last year, the top female chef in the world?
No, it was like 3 years ago.
3 years ago. Well, she is one right there at the top. And, listen.
And always has time to do. The wonderful thing is she always has time to talk to us.
Yeah, and she's wonderful. Elena Arzak is one of my most favorite people, and we always say to each other how good we look, and I love that, Elena.
I'm very happy to meet you again, and it's a surprise because I know you like very much the gastronomy, no?
Oh, yes.
And it's, you know, it's very nice to be here in New York. And
what have you been doing in New York?
I arrived yesterday, Saturday night, so I went. We are staying in the Nomad Hotel also. I went to a party to 11 Madison Park, and you know, in New York, it's always so much things to do. No, it's...
How often do you come to, like, New York and London and all that? Well, London, you're from Western, but how often do you get out of Spain and travel?
Well, fortunately, I travel very much, but I do very short travels because I want to be as much as possible with my father in the restaurant. I went to New York. I came to New York last year because I got an award from the CIA. Called Ogie Award, and I went to pick it up when it was an award with other women chefs, and it was really interesting. And 1 month ago, I went to Napa Valley, to the CIA in Greystone, to an event called Walls of Flavor. You know, it's so interesting because, you know, a chef, I think we need to see other food cultures, to see and to open your mind, not to copy, because... You know, in our level, if you copy, everybody sees. It's only to be inspired.
Well, Greystone will do it. I mean, the physical plant is so inspiring. And everybody feels like they're learning something when they're there, something new.
No, and for example, what for a chef is normal, for us is new, no? And this can give you new orientations. How to, for example, I like spices, no? But in San Sebastian, we use spices not so strong like for example, in London, or in the States that are different cultures together. No, you need to know what the people like and to cook for the people, not to cook only for you.
I'm getting sort of overwhelmed, but of course I've been doing this for a long time, but you have too, overwhelmed by this quest for new flavors all the time. Are you getting tired of it?
No, because, you know, you think that humans, we have a limit, but fortunately, the brain is always working, and... I think there are always new combinations or new ways of presentation food that can give you lots of new ways, no? And it's very nice, not because we don't cook like 20 years ago or we don't cook like in 10 years. We cook for today. And I like because how it changes the way of present the food, no? It is known that today... We eat more vegetables. The cooking periods are shorter. You understand? We want to have more healthy food, no? And also without forgetting the flavor.
But what about things like cloned animals and bugs and those things that everybody's doing? Insects.
Bueno, I think this is also a cultural. If you go to Mexico, for them it's normal to eat insects. No, in San Sebastian it's not normal. But like Ferran Adrià said once, you know, to eat a shrimp, is for us it's normal. But it's true that if you analyze the shrimp, it's like not an insect, but it's not because we are used to it, no?
But have you cooked like crickets and things?
Once I tried to fry ants, but you know, of course, I'm a person that I like to try new things, but perhaps I won't use them because I'm not used to them. No, perhaps I instead of ants, I prefer to eat truffle. No, for example.
I love you, Leila. Thank you for talking to us. Good luck on tonight's show.
Thank you, and I'm very pleased really to meet you because I know you adore the food. Yeah? Thank you.
I adore you and your dad too. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
You too, Leila.
And here we have Delbrije, which is outside of Amsterdam. That's the restaurant, number 38. And the chef, Johnny Burr.
Yeah, he was pretty excited to be in the top 50.
Exactly, such a little country, and to get one, you know, restaurant on the list is amazing. So, and it's supposed to be wonderful. So, listen to Johnny.
Explain again where your restaurant is.
My restaurant is in the Netherlands.
Right outside Amsterdam, you said, and it's called?
De Libreye in Zwolle.
And you were what number today?
38.
This is good. I heard from other people, by the way, that your restaurant is fabulous, and I think we may actually make a trip again, which I love Amsterdam, to your restaurant. And chef, owner?
Yes. I like it very much to be in the top 50, so I think the 38 is a very good place to start.
Give us your name.
My name is Johnny Boer, and that's my wife, Teresa.
Teresa is the knockout, in case you weren't wondering.
Sorry?
I said, you are a knockout, if nobody could see you, just hear you. Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much.
She's the best. She's the most beautiful wife in the whole building.
And I bet she helps a lot of the restaurant.
She is 80% of the success of my restaurant.
Tell us just one more thing.
Yes.
I mean, what is so special about your restaurant?
Oh, that's something I can't say. I think the customers have to say. But I think we do a lot of things with the region, but we don't do it for 2 years. We do it for almost 30 years. So the thing what is now a hype, we do it for 30 years already.
Now, how did you suddenly come on everybody's radar?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. I think, I don't know. I really don't know.
And it's a hard life being a chef, restaurateur's wife and co-partner, right?
Yes. It's not a hard life. It's a really nice life. It's really nice to have a restaurant together with Johnny and to work and to have pleasure and give all the guests a great evening. And it's the best there is.
And you've done it for how long?
We have the restaurant now for 25 years together.
And what did you do before doing this restaurant?
I was on school. I did hotel school, and I did education for a sommelier.
Well, you were a marvel, and you look gorgeous, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and here's another friend. We got to know him when we were in Lima a couple years ago. His restaurant is Maido, and he is Mitsuharu Sumura. And he is at number 13 on the list, but he got the highest climber award. And believe me, we've eaten at Maido, and it's
wonderful.
It's wonderful. He is by heritage Japanese, born and raised in Lima, or in Peru, I think it's Lima, but rigorously trained in Japan. Well, let's listen to what he has to say about what his latest adventures are.
We were in Lima, and I formed a best friendship with this guy, and we haven't seen each other since, and I'm so happy that all of a sudden he's back on the scene, big time, registering number 13 in the world's best restaurants, the top 100 restaurants in the world. He's number 13. Now, hello, Mitu. That's pretty good.
Well, very nice to see you again. It's a real pleasure, and, well, what better place than New York, you know? So I'm really happy to be here. I'm really happy for the award, and, well, what else can I say? Keep on working every day, you know, doing what we do, doing what we like to do, actually, and giving happiness to people, you know? That's the essence of cooking, actually.
Now, I mean, you had this one restaurant we went to. What was it called? I can't remember.
It's called Maido.
Maido, which was your flagship restaurant. And you have others now, too.
Actually, yes. We have a couple of restaurants in Lima. It's a more casual style. It's called Sushi Pop. It's a casual style sushi and appetizers, sandwiches. And right now we are opening in China, in Macau.
You're kidding.
Yeah, inside the MGM Grand. We are opening a restaurant called Aji. So that should be opened in March. We have a couple more projects in Latin America.
But, I mean, your tradition is Japanese-Peruvian. Right. Why are you opening in China?
Actually, it's because it was together with, for me, one of the most important companies or hotels in the world for food service and hospitality, which is the MGM, which is in Las Vegas also. So he's a very good partner, you know, to do nice things. And we're building a very nice restaurant inside the property.
I'm trying to remember. You had some really wonderful pisco thing, right?
Yes, actually, all of our cocktails, or most of them, are made with pisco and sake, which are the two drinks, you know, from Peru and from Japan.
Did you do craft beers, too?
Actually, we don't, but right now the craft beer scene in Peru, it's booming, so there are a lot of beers that are made with quinoa or peppercorn and many other ingredients that are not usual for making beer, so yeah, we use those beers.
I mean, I won't ever forget your restaurant because the presentations were so gorgeous. That's probably from you. I mean, I didn't introduce this properly. You are by family, ethnic, Japanese, but born in Peru.
Right. I was born in Peru. You know, my name is Mitsuharu, but everybody calls me Micha. You know, that's the way people know me. Because Mitsuharu is kind of difficult to pronounce, you know. So, well, I'm really happy for the award, and I don't know. It gives you more strength to keep on working.
But, you know, I mean, the food was the most refined, beautifully presented food that we had seen in a long time when we were in Lima.
Thank you very much for that. You know, it's the way we show our passion. And as I always say, my job or every chef's job is to give happiness to people. And the way we do it is by food. So it's like transmitting happiness to everybody, you know. I feed my soul with the happiness of our customers.
Okay, well, you have people coming up to claim you, but I want to tell you that I viewed you as this great buddy, and we have pictures on our website of you and me, and neither of us looks the same.
That is true. I gained a little bit of weight, but I mean, it was really nice to see you again.
Thank you too. Bye.
And if by now you've been wondering, well, we know this is the world's best restaurants, but where's the restaurant from the United States? Well, it turns out that number three, Daniel Hume and Will Gadira at 11 Madison Park, and Eric Repair from
La Bernadette
seemed to be too busy, too surrounded by adoring fans. But we did catch up with a new chef at the Modern, the Museum of Modern Art, who's an interesting new guy, and we have an interesting story associated with that restaurant anyway. So we were delighted to have a chance to talk to Abram Bissell. And in case you're wondering, no, we did not go to lunch the next day. But we will soon.
Of course, MoMA. And we were there with the opening chef, and we predicted that he won the Beard Award that year. And now we have the current executive chef, Abram Bissell, and he just hosted, and that has to be an awesome, awesome experience. All the winners of the 50 Best from last year And who else, Abram?
Last night, all of the 50 best from 2015 were at the Modern, plus one, as well as sponsors, media. Incredible experience to serve the best of the world, the best chefs of the world at our restaurant.
And are you going to tell us what you served?
Yes, of course. Well, actually, tonight as well, Norwegian king crab was one of the prominent, beautiful, beautiful crabs, live crabs. So we did marry with green tomatoes, borage, and basil, which is all just starting up. And then we did a whole baby lamb. So all the parts of the lamb braised and roasted, rolled into a large roulade and glazed with a lot of family-style vegetables that are really peaking right now. So beans and peas and fresh hearts of escarole. Just a beautiful casual evening for everyone to enjoy and hang out together.
Are you open for lunch tomorrow?
We are. We are open for lunch tomorrow.
We'll be there.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love that. You have to come in. You have to come in.
Tell me where you...
Do this seriously. We're going to do this. You better do it seriously. We're going to come back to the airport and everything.
Tell me this. Before there, because you're still young, where were you?
I actually was a cook at the Modern when the Modern first opened, so 12 years ago. My first restaurant when I moved to New York City was with Gabriel Kreutzer in the kitchen. And I left the Modern to move down to 11 Madison Park, and I spent 8 years at 11 Madison Park with Daniel Hume. And with Daniel Hume opened the Nomad on Broadway. I was there for the last... Yeah, probably was. I was there for 2 years after opening. And just 2.5 years ago, moved back up and took over the Modern when Gabriel left to open his own restaurant.
How is his restaurant going?
Gabriel's? Oh, it's amazing. I was lucky enough to eat in the first month it opened, and it was already a world-class experience. So, you know, that's the very beginning for him, and he's such a talented chef, and I feel like I'm lucky to have worked for him. I still consider him to be one of my mentors.
So if he's your primary mentor, I have a general idea of his style of cooking. Is that like yours?
No, I would say that Gabriel was a great influence on me, especially on how a kitchen should operate and seasoning and making sure that flavors are bold and powerful. But I think that, you know, I have a style that's mine. I don't like to describe it in any particular way other than saying we focus on making everything as delicious as possible. But my background comes from, I grew up in South Florida, so I cook with a lot of seafood. It's definitely my focus is seafood, not entirely, but it's what I really love to cook and to feature.
Well, how did you wend your way to New York from South Florida? South Florida, I just read, was having some sort of renaissance.
South Florida is, I left South Florida 20 years ago, so I've been gone for a while. I've lived the entire country, all the way up the East Coast, down the West Coast. And I always knew New York was where I wanted to be. I always knew that was a city where I wanted to plant my feet, and I wanted to have my restaurant and my future here. So I love the city. I love the energy. I love how it constantly pushes you to be more than you were the day before. I love the excitement. Right? It's just the best place to be. Greatest city in the world, New York.
Well, I'm so glad we met you, and I can't wait to taste your cooking.
Yeah. I hope to see you tomorrow for lunch, right?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
One of the hottest boroughs of New York, of course, is Brooklyn. And we did spend some time there.
We sure did.
Yeah, we went to two restaurants. One, which we just adored. We had more fun at Fetty Sal. Fetty Sal means fat pig, and it's a barbecue joint. And it's the food was fabulous, and they had all manner. We tried everything. And then the other one we went to, an unusual, it's a one Michelin star restaurant called Luxus, which is the only Michelin-starred restaurant that has a beer tasting menu, and I mean, yeah, we had beer with the tasting menu.
They have no wines in the house. The front is a bar called Torst, which means thirst, and the back is a restaurant called Luxus, which means luxurious, and it seats only 18 people. And we sat there and ate and had a really good time. And
I still don't like sour beer.
There you go. Yeah, and still doesn't like sour beer. There you go.
So, sorry, Daniel. Okay, Daniel Burns is the chef.
Well, anyway, Daniel Burns has already appeared on the program. Fede Sau will be coming soon to the program as soon as we can connect with Chef Carroll's busy schedule.
Joe Carroll,
yeah. And as far as your own guide to Brooklyn, well, there's a restaurant called Brooklyn Bar Bites.
Yeah, which is Barbara Scott Goodman. And she's going to take us on a little tour. Barbara Scott Goodman, you bit off a very, I would say, volatile subject, because every day there's something new in Brooklyn, and yet you wrote Brooklyn Bar Bites, Great Dishes and Cocktails from New York's Food Mecca. So you must have had a lot of confidence in what you picked to feature in the book, because it could easily change in 2 minutes.
Well, it actually did change while I was working on the book.
Okay.
So I almost felt like when I was out sampling food and drink, I was almost going to ask the owner if I could see their lease to see how long they'd be in business. And unfortunately, well, last year while I was working on this, there was a horrible winter, and a couple places we worked with and actually developed recipes for did go out of business, but I don't know, their stuff was so good, and I enjoyed working with them so much that we put a little section in the back, kind of an in memoriam section celebrate that they did exist and their food was great. And for a number of reasons, places go out of business, but fortunately, most of them are still in business, and there's so much lead time built into a book. It was a factor. It really was something I had to think about, like what looks like it's going to stay here and where is their thriving business. So, yeah, that was really a consideration.
You know, I had a two-month leave when I was doing monthly restaurant criticism for the City Magazine. And, I mean, I would have these poor little fact checkers call. I would say, "Oh, the restaurant's closed." You know?
just as it's about to run as hot news in the magazine, of course.
It's a tricky business. It's a very volatile time, and my hat's off to all the people who do this, who work in the restaurant business. And as you know, it's tough.
Right. Now,
you have to be careful. There's the fine old philosopher lady called Mrs. Nora Davidson, who happens to be my mother, and her piece of advice for you would be to not bite off more than you can chew. she had literally thousands of them. Sadly, she's dearly remembered. Unfortunately, she's deceased, but she left an impression on everyone surrounding her in terms of adages and pieces of sound advice.
Good story.
Now, tell me, you didn't necessarily pick all the most famous or the most popular of these new Brooklyn
hangouts
places.
Well, I was really looking for places that the criteria was the food. The criteria was really like who is making really good food in this bar setting. And I thought that was the most interesting part of the way, you know, the sort of whole movement in food now is that people, and especially younger people who have settled out here, don't really go out to dinner in a traditional way.
Wow.
I'm not saying everyone, but there's a lot of, especially because I think of the dollar oyster scene, that people go, oh, let's go over here and have oysters.
Yeah.
And then let's go someplace else and have a burger. And the other part is, you know, you can do a lot of this on foot, so you don't have to worry about driving. So it's sort of like a lot of people go out on crawls, and you can sort of snack your way around the whole borough if you're strong enough.
Well, I mean, I was reading somewhere that the major change in dining patterns is that people don't eat meals anymore. And I mean, I know, our kids, for example, It's, I think, only when we're there do they sit down and actually have a family meal.
Right.
And
right.
I have the friend's daughter. She just puts, she has three children. She puts all the food on the table and says, if you're hungry, grab something as you're going by.
Yeah, it's more of a grazing experience.
Exactly.
Than,
I think it's primitive. I don't care. I think it's primitive.
Grazing.
Well, I think it's also, in the case of Brooklyn and the city, it's financial, too. It's very expensive to go to a restaurant and do the whole appetizer, entree, dessert thing now. And if you have drinks or wine, it really, really adds up. And I thought that this whole casual, let's go out for drinks and get something to eat, and then the fact that the food was really good was the thing that hooked me. I said, oh, there are a lot of chefs who don't want to own a big restaurant and deal with all that, but they'd rather just do bar food or some kind of smaller plate, and the food really, they really enjoy doing it that way rather than doing the whole restaurant.
Barchuco is one of the ones we should really pay attention to when we're in Brooklyn.
Yes, the food is really excellent. The chef is a young woman from the West Coast, and she's very knowledgeable about all kinds of Asian food. But it's really like designed after a Japanese izakaya, where mm-hmm. it's all snacks to have with drinks. And it started out that they have a restaurant across the street, which is very well known too for their ramen. There's always a line. People,
I love kids, ramen.
The ramen's great.
I mean, the good stuff. I still remember college days, that instant ramen, which was pretty awful.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, they're an offshoot of a ramen restaurant. So because the lines were so long, they made a second place where people could go and have drinks and snacks while they were waiting for their ramen. And it sort of developed into its own, it's a restaurant on its own, restaurant bar, and it's really, really special.
Right. Some of the dishes are imaginative, creative, and a lot of them, though, are really classics, aren't they? Like the oysters and the tacos and...
Right. Well, oysters used to be, you could get them in the river in Manhattan.
I know,
for those are the real old days.
But they used to feed them to the prisons. That's one of the things they used to give to prisoners, right? Oysters? Or was that lobster?
It was lobsters.
Lobster. Yeah.
They probably gave them oysters, too. But.
Yeah, so there are classics, and I would say when bars were first sort of starting out, they would do deviled eggs were always on the menu.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so I didn't even know if I would have wanted to do deviled egg recipe for this book, but the one place where I thought they were so extraordinary was at the Clover Club on Smith Street in Brooklyn. And he has this variation. There's a picture. I don't know if you have the book. There's a picture on the back cover.
Yes.
And they're really, really good.
They look wonderful.
And it sort of takes this very everyday dish into the whole next level. And the chef there is very good. And he also makes Hato chips that are cooked in duck fat.
Oh, I love that.
They're crazy good. They're so good. There were a lot of twists on classics that I liked.
And what is the general age of the people who do the bar crawls?
Well, I'm sure I'm probably the oldest one.
Yeah.
But I would say, well, there's so many young people living in Brooklyn now who, got priced out of Manhattan.
And now they're getting priced out of Brooklyn.
They're getting priced out of Brooklyn, yeah. And they're going to Queens. So
that is the end of the rope for me, Queens.
Never say never.
No.
So, there's a lot of young working kids, and I had written about in the beginning that, especially in cities, people really like to congregate in bars because they don't want to be in their office, and they may not want to be home or in their tiny apartment or in their apartment with, a bunch of roommates. They need that third place.
You need
that other place where you can go and on your own, relax, have a drink, read a book, or you can meet friends, and it's really, cities really are full of good places to do that, and I think it provides a nice break from, I mean, it's really fun to go out to bars and have, you know, with your friends and have a lot of fun. But it's also, if you just need a little break and right. want to have a drink or a cup of coffee or something to eat, it's just, and the, if the atmosphere is good, it's a nice place to have.
Well, yeah, well, doing what I do, eating for a living, my third place is the gym.
Right. Well, there's that, too.
So this, the shepherd's, vegetable shepherd's pie looks beautiful.
It's actually all vegetarian, too. It's all vegetarian, and you could even do it as vegan if you wanted to without using butter in the potatoes. And that is a beautiful dish. Actually, we were at Grand Ferry this past weekend, and we went with a friend who's vegetarian, and she ordered that. It looked delicious and tasted delicious.
I don't know what happens next with the, I mean, I guess everything just keeps turning over in Brooklyn. Did you see that New York Magazine issue where they had all, it was a map of all the boroughs, Brooklyn, with all the artisanal products? Did you see that?
Yes, I did, and I think it's just going to keep exploding. You know, the other thing is that they're out here compared to Manhattan, there's room. I mean, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where the debates were last night, it's vast, and it was always, you know, it was unused for a long time, and people are starting to realize that, oh, my goodness, I could actually manufacture something here, like Mast Brothers is a chocolate company. Well, and they're going to be based there.
That's probably not a good example. They're in a lot of trouble.
Well, they'll be okay.
I don't know. I've had nasty dealings with them, to tell you the truth.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Oh, but, okay, so other than Mass, Russ and Daughters.
That's good. Yeah.
They're going to be out there, and they're going to use that space as manufacturing. And it's really, you know, there are vast warehouses and a lot of room for people to work and manufacture here and actually make stuff, which is pretty great.
Yeah. Now, Barbara, you're probably on to the next book by now, I would think. You haven't had a long enough break between, but you probably have to move on to your next book. You've been doing this for a long time.
I have been doing this. Mm-hmm.
Right, and well, this is the publisher, Rizzoli, produces some of the they're just so, they're sensitive and inspiring, their books, and I love the size of this one. It fits the subject perfectly. I wish you a great deal of success with it.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and hopefully we'll run into each other at some point.
Yes, and when you come to Brooklyn and for your event, bring the book and try a few places.
Right, I will.
Okay.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Ann.
And finishing up today's program,
it has nothing to do with New York.
Nothing to do with
the 50 best.
It's nothing to do with haute cuisine. We thought those of you who are not into haute cuisine might like a change of pace.
Yeah.
So go ahead. What's the name of the book?
It's Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen.
There you go. It's anything in contrast with the previous segment of the program. Well, we hope so, and we hope you'll enjoy this conversation too.
Francine Bryson keeps winning competitions and prizes, mainly actually for her pies, but she has a cookbook out called Country Cooking from a Redneck Kitchen, where she explores the savory as well as the sweets in the South. Welcome to On the Menu, Francine.
Thank you.
I'm going to start, and I want to throw you on this, but by your definition, what is a redneck?
It's not an episode of Hee Haw. Sure, everybody thinks it's Hee Haw or Beverly Hillbilly. A redneck is sort of just live and let live. You live off the land, hunt fish, grow your own vegetables, laid back, sort of just take things as they come. It's a way of life is what it is. It's not overalls and banjo music and bare feet, which I do run around with bare feet and I do like banjo music, but it's just a way of life. It's not a label. it's not. I don't know, Jeff Foxworthy told me one time, he says the word redneck means a, what is it, what did he say? It was a slacking amount of sophistication. And I explained to him that I knew which fork to use, which course, which part of the meal, and that did not apply to me. So.
Now, it's not always considered a term of endearment or a term of respect, but you think it is, right?
I think it is. I think if people actually, the sad thing is most of the country, when they hear word redneck, they think hee-haw, or they think the Beverly Hillbillies, or they think, you know, we're a bunch of mountain folks that never come out of the woods or things. And that's sad because that's not really the truth. And things have changed so much over the years, and we've all got more sophisticated. And I mean, we have technology and cell phones and computers and everything. But I think redneck is just a way of life. It's sort of just living by your own means and just, I don't know, it's just laid back.
Well, now what distinguishes redneck kitchen from the bulk of southern cooking that we've come to learn so much about?
I've been asked this so many times. I call it my redneck kitchen because I live in a mobile home. I don't live in a foundation house. I live in a mobile home, and I call it my redneck kitchen. But the being called redneck, and this is what's so weird, being called redneck really did not catch on until Jeff Foxworthy did it to me on the set of the baking show, and he started calling me redneck every day. It kicked in, and everybody was like, okay, she's the redneck. And I actually am, and I'm kind of proud of it. I'm proud of the fact of where I come from and where I live. I love where I'm from.
Now, this Foxworthy, is he like a TV person? I don't think I've ever heard of him.
Oh, Jeff Foxworthy is one of the most award-winning comedians in the country.
Oh,
he lives in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
And he's famous for the term, you might be a redneck if.
Oh,
he's,
I see. Okay.
So. Yeah, he's really, really famous in the country world, so, and in the South.
So he's
King Redneck.
See, I learned that a redneck, the term derived from the fact that they were people who worked out in the fields in the sun and got red necks, I mean, sunburned.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what the original meaning was, and it was farmers, actually, and people called them rednecks because of that. But over the years, you don't see many people out in the fields here in like Oklahoma or Kansas where they're growing corn and, you know, 500 acres of green beans and things. You really just don't see that much anymore. And a lot of people don't realize that that's where it derived, and it's turned into this laid-back country folks. But nowadays, they do attribute it to the Hee Haw Show or the Beverly Hillbillies or to the Andy Griffith Show and things like that.
But for you, Francine, It's good. It's good old country cooking that you learned at the feet of your parents and your grandparents.
Exactly. It just, to me, it's endearment because they've taught me how to cook. They taught me how to clean house. They taught me how to sew. They taught me how to quilt, make my own blankets, make my own clothes. They taught me how to survive, and I'm proud of that. Very, very proud of that.
Well, you have like every single southern staple I could think of in this book. And
there's more.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's more. I mean, we've had a slew of southern, and we've covered a lot of the southern food and wine festivals. We did Charleston for years, and we're still doing Nashville, and you know, went down Greenville when it had it. You're the first person I know that actually includes recipes in a cookbook that you hate and wouldn't eat. I'm talking okra, your okra recipe, which, by the way, we just had the other day, and the way we do it, I like it.
Yeah, I cooked about a pound of okra two nights ago, and Ann ate more than half of it all in one sitting.
Uh-huh. My daughter can eat it, but down here we call it okri.
Okri.
So it actually, yeah, so it's actually spelled O-R-K-I-E.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, it's just like, you know, taters and maters instead of potatoes and tomatoes or tomatoes. But my daughter loves okra, and I have never, ever in my life fashioned a love for it. And that's, I put that recipe in there for her because that's one of her favorite foods.
Tell our listeners the story of the liver.
Oh, yeah, the liver.
The liver, the liver that
I never think of liver as onion. Being southern. I never think of that as being southern.
I was raised that it was southern because it was every Thursday we had liver and onions. That was my mama's you had to have liver and onions on Thursdays. And growing up, I didn't like it. I didn't like the, to me, it tasted like chalk. And the more I chewed, the bigger it got. And I was raised where you sit down at the table and you sit there till you finish your meal.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, trying to choke down a whole plate of liver was kind of rough.
Now, hey, Francine, it's really funny. Mm-hmm. In my house growing up in the north of England, where they're certainly not rednecks because there's no way you get your neck red because there's no sunshine. But in our house, the liver was Wednesday.
Well, I think everybody, no matter where you're from, what country you're from, or what part of the country you're from, I think everybody has that staple that they grew up with, that they attribute it to something from childhood. Like, you know, maybe they ate spaghetti on Tuesday nights, and maybe everybody had roast beef on Sunday afternoons, you know, because it could be put in the oven before you left for church, and things like that. And the liver, to me, I had to put it in there because of my mom, and she was, my mom was very, very animus about, you're going to learn to like this, and you're going to learn to eat this. And I'm thankful that she did, because when I was going through chemo, because I had liver cancer, it was the liver that actually built my blood up enough to be able to handle treatment. Because the doctor's like, you need to take iron pills and iron supplements, and they just made me sick. And I would eat liver like 3 times a week, and it would build my blood up to where I didn't have to take so many supplements, and I didn't stay sick.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I wish my mother had had your recipe. She used to boil it up with onions, and if there was no beef liver to be had, we had to have pig's liver, which is
even worse.
Yeah.
which is not so great. Now we have had goat liver.
Yeah, that's
and we really like that. You can't.
No, I can't do goat. I like goat milk cheese, but I can't drink goat milk. I can't eat goat. And a lot of people, goat is a delicacy in places.
Oh,
and I can't do it. It's like eating, and what's weird is we do live off the land. Like we eat squirrel and we eat deer and we eat turkey.
Oh yeah, we wanted to talk about squirrel because we interviewed someone who had a recipe for Brunswick stew, yeah. And of course the standard ingredient in Brunswick stew is squirrel, although you don't mm-hmm. include it. You have a separate recipe for squirrel stew in your book, but you don't include squirrel in your recipe for Brunswick
right.
stew. But
right.
when we were doing the interview, Peter asked, because she didn't specify how many squirrels, and she said 5, but your recipe calls for 6.
Right. It really depends on the size, but the Brunswick stew down here, we use like leftover pork, and then we use chicken for Brunswick stew. Now, in Kentucky, they make Brunswick stew, and they put the rabbit in it, and it's called burgoo.
Oh, right. Is that what burgoo is?
Yeah, that's burgoo. That's the stew they make
okay.
before the Kentucky Derby.
That's
right.
I mean, what's Marcy and Lawn? They're opposite sides of Kentucky, of one mountain in Kentucky, and they argue endlessly about what goes into burgoo. I mean, he's a chef, so he should know. But anyhow.
Yeah. I think every region has its own twist on everything, and that's the cool thing about Southern food is what we think are staples here may not be staples in, say, Knoxville, Tennessee. And that's, to me, it's odd because my favorite thing is when I travel is I hunt those places that you haven't seen on TV or that you don't see advertised on a billboard. I hunt those little mom and pop places to eat that are not widely advertised, and that's usually where the best food is.
Yeah.
Especially places that look like it's a dive. And I actually have an uncle that was raised in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And when we would go visit him, he would make burgoo, and he used rabbit.
Uh-huh.
So some people nice. Use squirrel, some people use rabbit. And we make it out of pork and chicken, and we call it Brunswick stew.
Well, now, the biggest section of your book is not surprisingly sweets. Because, I mean, that's how you got your reputation, really.
Right.
Didn't you?
Right.
You're called the queen of pies or something, is it?
I've been called pie girls. I've been called the queen of pie. I've been called all kinds of things.
So
but
what's your secret?
I think I just enjoy food. I enjoy experimenting. That I think that's the secret. Is I'm not scared to put something together that people wouldn't expect. I'm not scared of a new flavor. And sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. There's been a lot of don'ts. But it's just, I think the experimentation is one of the greatest parts about cooking, and it's like my daddy told me years and years ago. He says, no matter what you're doing, whether it's your job, your life, your family, you're always learning. And when you stop learning, then you're dead. And that's what it is. Food is learning. And I love experimenting. I love going to a new grocery store and finding, like, I went to Texas last fall and found a jam made out of bacon. And
Oh, well, that brings me to this. I thought this was unusual. Your upside down apple bacon pie.
Right. That's a variation of the, there's a grand champion pie in my first book, and it's apple, upside down apple pecan pie. And I just substituted, instead of using pecans, I used the weed bacon. And they, it's the same as that pie. It just has a bacon topping instead of, well, it's actually a bacon bottom, and you flip it over instead of pecans. But you can still put pecans in if you want to.
Now, you have a really interesting section where you essentially you have recipes for large numbers of people, including Your father or your grandfather's chili recipe, which is so popular, your daddy's recipe, and there's a whole series of those. And that's really nice because you say even if you're not a large group, you can make according to this recipe, and then you'll have leftovers for a week.
Right, and that's one of the things about being down here is, and people that, like, cook for two people can't do that to save my life. I have tried, but I cannot cook small quantities. I have never, I mean, if I make a batch of macaroni and cheese, there's enough there to feed 15 people.
Well, how many in your family, and growing up, how big was your family?
There was just four of us. It was my mom and my dad and me and my little brother. But we always had somebody around us. There was always cousins or neighbors or friends or, you know, grandparents. There was always, a meal wasn't just the four of us. It was always a gathering. Whether it was Sunday afternoon or Thursday night, there was always somebody over at the house, or I was always over at my grandparents' house, and then everybody showed up. It was just, food was always an event for us.
No, I like the whole concept of the chapter, and I think it would help a lot of home cooks who typically don't deal with large groups of people, and then when they're faced with that, they get entirely hysterical. So
and it's almost intimidation. A lot of people are intimidated by food and intimidated by recipes, and that's one of the things I learned very early on is you shouldn't let the food intimidate you. There's things out there that I cannot, that does intimidate me, but I face it head on and go on about my business. But it's like salmon. I won't eat salmon. Yeah, I don't like salmon. I just don't like it. I never liked it.
Do you like fish in general?
I like catfish.
See, that's the one fish I won't eat.
catfish is my favorite fish. I like grouper when I'm on the coast. It has to be fresh. I don't like it frozen. I like cod when I'm up north. I like shellfish. I like shrimp, crab, lobster, crawfish. I love crawfish. Crawfish is like one of my favorite shellfish in the world. I love oysters. I love anything out of the ocean. Absolutely adore anything out of the ocean.
Well, I got to tell you, listeners, I've been reading through this book. The one thing you may be sure is that every single recipe here has a whole lot of taste.
It does. There's definitely no, you know, slack on flavor in our food. And that's one of the great things about food is it should be flavorful. It shouldn't be bland. I mean, seriously.
Well, this certainly is not bland.
So listen, we're going to... Next time we're in Greenville, just down the road from you, maybe you'll rustle up a batch of squirrel stew for us.
Sure. We might even go so far as have some squirrel and dumplings.
There we go. And in the meantime, keep in touch if you come out with any more documentation of your culinary adventures.
I definitely will. And believe me, it's not stopping here, that's for sure.
Thanks,
we're just getting started.
Okay, Francine, well, continued success.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. On the Menu is back, sampling Peter's delicious cuisine and generally resuming life as normal instead of life in a hectic New York City in a splendid party adventure. And That's all. Until next week, where we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.